Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Simone Tagliapietra, I'm a senior fellow at Bruegel, and we are here for a special episode of our live series to comment on the outcome of COP26 and on what's next for global climate action in 2022. I'm here with Li Shu, senior global policy advisor at Greenpeace China. Hello, Li. I'm here with Diederik Samson, head of cabinet of executive vice president of the European Commission, Frans Timmermans. Good morning, Diederik. And we will be joined soon by Laurence Tubiana, CEO of the European Climate Foundation. Hello to you all, and thanks for joining in. Let me remind that our listeners can also join our conversation, so you are all invited to do so, by asking questions on Slido using the hashtag COP26. Diederik, let me turn to you, perhaps, directly to start our conversation here and ask the following. In the final hours of COP26, we have seen Frans Timmermans expressing his disappointment about the last minute watering down of the final text, but also he expressed his satisfaction for the achievements of the conference. From the EU perspective, is the Glasgow glass half full or half empty?
I would say a bit more than half full. It's never full, completely full. There's no COP that is perfect. Even the much celebrated Paris was not perfect. But this one ranks for me, having been at almost all of them, in the top five of COPs. Because yes, you're right about the disappointing part of last hour, which was actually about one sentence in the cover conclusions, which were not part of the agreement or the UNFCCC framework itself, but maybe we get to that later. Let's look at where we are within the UNFCCC framework. Before entering into Glasgow, we were clearly not on a pathway towards 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degree. And now, after Glasgow, we stand a chance. And that's the main accomplishment, obviously. On top of that, we have finally, and which is not a small accomplishment, closed the rule book, which enable us to make this whole system work in the end. And we have enshrined much, much firmer than we had in Paris or before that, the 1.5 degree as actually the new benchmark, the new point where we should go. The whole conclusions of Glasgow are about 1.5 degree. And on top of that, we have shortened the deadline putting in your new NDCs to make up for the gap towards 1.5 degree. Obviously, that latter part is the most, is still to be seen whether we can make that in the next 12 months. But we haven't given ourselves, because this concerns all of us, we haven't given ourselves more than those 12 months up to Egypt to deliver on the remaining NDCs that still need to be there in order to close the gap towards 1.5 degrees. And on top of that, we have made progress, not much more than that, but okay, progress on a more structural financial framework to cover mitigation, but also adaptation and loss and damage up to and especially after 2025. Most of that work still needs to be done, but the beginning is there. So all in all, I would say the glass is much more than half full.
Thank you, Diederik, for this first take on the conference. And in the meantime, we have been joined by Laurence Tubiana. Good morning, Laurence. And maybe let me bring you into the conversation, if I may, by asking what are, in your view, the main achievements of COP26, and what are, in your view, the major shortfalls of the conference?
Good morning. And listening to this show, I probably share his evaluation. Glasgow was important and has been important for really making Paris workable. It has completed the two or three elements, the three elements we needed to really make Paris applicable. And that was important, in particular on the transparency mechanism. You know that the transparency mechanism is a way that every country can exert a peer pressure between each other. And there was a lot of conversation since now many years, but it has been achieved. And so now we have a common framework with, of course, flexibilities for developing countries in a way to check and begin to check where are the different countries. And that is, of course, an important element. The second one is really to have achieved the carbon markets rule of law, how the rule will, in a way, frame the carbon markets. Important because, again, it was a very long discussion. There are still loopholes in that, in particular on the voluntary ones, but at least there is quite good rules, in particular on the accounting, and I think that's as well very important. And third, even if it has been not noticed so much by the press, now everybody agrees that the NDCs has to take a 5 years in a rhythm, that every 5 years you have to present a new one. On the 2022 deadline, in a way, for revising the NDCs, it was a good progress because we missed the date with Glasgow. Glasgow was meant to, following Paris Agreement decisions, to have the moment where all countries will have to revise and finalize their NDCs. And finally, this hasn't happened really, or in a very uneven way. So we gave us 1 year more, and with the idea that we will use more the idea of a continuous improvement, which is in Paris Agreement, but for the moment there was quite a resistance to that. But we see that now everybody agrees, every country agrees that we need to look at these NDCs and revise them in a more permanent way. The other element was, of course, not need so much to comment on the call phase down or phase out. Of course, it's a compromise discussion, but you see that now the more specific attention to fossil fuels explicitly, which was very difficult to discuss in Paris. We tried, the formula could not work. So it's a progress that Glasgow has operated to concentrate on the concrete actions, which I think is very good. And finally, I would say there was on finance, of course, and that's sort of the intermediate between the good thing and the shortfalls. And again, of course, reaffirming the 1.5 is really important, as Lucio said. What I think on the finance, of course, we saw the difficulty of the international financial system to respond to the climate crisis. It's evident that's why we are just having a discussion that there is a very little trust, in particular in developing countries that have difficult access to capital markets, to believe that this money is there to help for the transition. And that, I think, is a very, very big conclusion we should think about, because all the announcement of the private finance possibilities, availability, in particular through voluntary alliance to go green on the private finance side, and on the other side, the lack of capacity to mobilize the public finance, the 100 billion per year that was promised by 2020, is something you see that the system doesn't respond really. And I think that may be the biggest shortfall, that really we don't have the tools now. We have given some ideas of the tools, but don't really, it's not working. That's quite evident. The only example which was presented as a success is 8.5 billion that mostly European countries and UK has mobilized for South Africa to support the energy transition plan. So it could be an interesting model, but it was a particular effort, and to make it general is really a challenge. And finally, I think I would say the loss and damage thing was, the elephant in the room. The extreme events have, of course, multiplied since Paris. The impacts have multiplied. The depth consequences of these extreme events are now very, very heavy. And for the moment, the response is not there, and it's very difficult. So that's a new challenge, I think, for Sharm el-Sheikh, but more broadly, again, for the international financial system to respond to that.
Thank you, Laurence. Thank you indeed. And let me now turn to Lee to really try to focus a little bit more on what the role of China and India has been here. On the one hand, the two countries were, of course, we have said that, the protagonist of the last hours of the conference, with the last minute push to weaken the conclusions on coal and fossil fuel subsidies. But on the other end, we have also seen an unprecedented climate commitment coming out of India and a surprise agreement between China and the United States to boost climate action this decade. So, Lee, what's your take on all this?
Sure. Yeah. First of all, thanks very much for having me. Let me just say, there are many ways that we can look at the COP. I think from an environmental point of view, I have to also point out the empty half, or more than half empty part of the glass, which is, if you look at the analysis done by many consultancy NGOs, for example, Climate Action Tracker, they're basically saying the NDCs submitted, right, so far this year, if you take those targets at their face value, it will still take us to 2.4 degree of global warming. And if you look at the actual policies that have been put into place, the temperature rise will be even higher than that. We're looking at a 2.7 degree temperature rise. So that's, I think the environmental challenge that we have. But if I look at, the COP from a diplomatic point of view, I have to say, the overall process was managed relatively well, right? I mean, it was relatively smooth sailing compared to many previous COPs, considering the stake of Glasgow. But that said, I also agree with Laurence. I think there is, a lack of balance in the overall political package, in the sense that on the mitigation side, very positively, 1.5 was very strongly anchored into the final deal. There is also a hook for countries to revisit and strengthening their NDC next year. But when we look at, finance, adaptation, loss and damage, I think the deliverable on those issues are relatively weak. On China and India, I think the haggle over coal, right, phase out versus phase down at the last minute of the COP is kind of an interesting way to conclude the COP. I try to read this last minute haggle in a positive way, in the sense that this really brought the issue of coal to the fore, right? All the countries, particularly the major coal consumers, cannot hide away from the imperative to do something on coal, right? They still disagree on the final destination, but I think the overall direction was already agreed and anchored in a very prominent way in the Glasgow outcome. One word on the U.S.-China joint statement, which was reached just a few days before the conclusion of the COP, it set a very cooperative tone between the two countries. I think for the rest of the world, we should welcome that, if we consider how difficult the bilateral relationship between the two countries have been when you look at many other bilateral and geopolitical issues. The joint statement also outlined a number of areas the two countries will need to work together in 2022. But I think the most important thing that people need to realize is the joint statement also addressed a few issues related to what Glasgow discussed. In particular, how do we raise ambition, right, going forward? And there in the U.S.-China joint statement, the provision was actually weaker than what we reached in the end in Glasgow. We simply just recall the Paris language, right? Update and communicate NDC without saying when. Whereas the Glasgow language said we need to revisit and strengthen with a very clear timeline, which is by the end of 2022. What does that tell us? I think that tells us the rest of the world are not necessarily waiting for the G2. The G2 are sort of delayed by their domestic politics, by their bilateral relationship, And I think the climate urgency demands the multilateral forces now to actually move faster than the G2.
Thank you, Lee. And I think this was a perfect complementary view on what we have been saying so far. And I think we might now try to move into the more forward-looking part of our conversation, if you wish. So trying to really understand what's next after the COP. And if I may, Laurence, I would turn to you to start asking you, what are, in your view, or what should be, in your view, the global climate action priorities after COP26? So what should be the main item in the global climate action agenda for next year?
Something we have not mentioned is the progress and the more and more evidence that, you know, climate is a regime of actions and norms that are broader than, of course, government only. And in the philosophy of the Paris Agreement, there was already the recognition that non-state actors in general, non-parties, if I may say so, has to contribute to the goals. And that was, of course, that's something that was very present and evident in Glasgow and indicate, in a way, a number of action to develop more ambition on mitigation and on the other side, really to consider seriously the problem of adaptation and loss and damage. All the voluntary commitments that were taken in particular in the first week, both sometimes a mix of private sector actors and governments, like methane, for example, or forest, the declaration on forest on deforestation. There is, of course, the private finance element. So there was a lot of non-parties to the Paris Agreement that expressed their willingness and their intention to follow the goals of the, in particular, referring to net zero by 2050 for their emissions. And for which is anyway a big progress. It's a individual translation of the global goal of Paris and in line with 1.5 as a temperature goal. This show a straightforward line of action. The first one is, whether it is coal, methane, forest, or others, this has to be included because there is no accountability mechanism for all these voluntary commitments. So they should be, as much as we can get there, incorporated in the new NDCs in 2022. So that first line, a very simple one, not an easy necessary one, but this voluntary has to come in the NDCs to be incorporated in the accountability mechanisms that now exist in Paris Agreement structure. The second element, in my view, is, of course, to think about how we will not only harmonize, but really create this new regime of governance, which has to complete what the agreement between governments is about. And we need all these actors. We need, in particular, I'm thinking about the subnational level. And we have seen in Glasgow a lot of governors of the state of Brazil, the provinces of Australia, and we can go on. And we have seen, of course, the importance of their involvement on the US side when US government has decided to withdraw from Paris. So these actors, but it's true for the businesses, it's true for the alliance of asset owners, of investors. We have to see how we incorporate them in the climate regime structure with, in a way, a condition of accountability and seriousness, meaning they have to deliver what they promise, but they should be much more connected to the government to government discussion. And that's necessary because if not, we have in a way two atmospheres, which are confusing in a way, is where is the ambition? That's why, as Li Shuo mentioned, there was different evaluation at the end of the first week. One saying, like the International Energy Agency, we are very close to 1.8 as a global temperature goal, if I take all these voluntary commitments, or we are in reality above 2 degrees, 2.4 or even more. So this is confusing. And this is important to now just raise this confusion. And that's, in my view, the two direction. And third, on the finance, I think, again, we have now a discussion that has to be brought up to the IMF and World Bank scene, because on one side, there was an appeal in particular from the vulnerable countries led by the Prime Minister of Barbados to use now the SDR, the special drawing rights, as a way to, in a way, support the energy transition. There was other calls on really mobilizing the private capitals that now the MDBs and the development financial institutions are not doing. And so that is the second element. And then, of course, is, of course, frankly, to recognize that the World Bank is not delivering on what the World Bank should do. And so this is a big, big scope of action. And I think Europe on all these financial issues is really, really well placed. One, because we have a work on the taxonomy very seriously. Second, because we have a big say in the board of these institutions. And third, because we have been very, very, Europe has been a model in bringing the South Africa, in a way, coalition behind the plan. So I hope that we take the lead on that. And that very, very, in a way, crucial from now to the spring meetings in of IMF and World Bank. But I'll stop there as some piece of actions.
Thank you very much, Laurence. And this also gives me the opportunity to turn to Diederik, because we have heard about the EU playing, of course, a very important role, notably on the finance side, the cooperation model with South Africa, of which, of course, the EU is a key partner, can be replicated perhaps to other countries. So, Diederik, in your view, what will be the key international climate priorities for the EU in 2022? And is this model, this deal with South Africa, that also Frans Timmermans mentioned at the end of the conference, might really be a new form of cooperation moving forward with other countries?
Yes, sure. So in short, that is one of the work strands that we are going to work on and broaden. India, Vietnam, Philippines, there's quite a few countries that are that could enter into the same kind of arrangements. But the priorities for 2022 are pretty simple. We need to get those missing NDCs on the table. And obviously, there's a lot of them, but you can concentrate on the big nine so that we have that will close the gap in the ultimate situation, that they all deliver exactly what is needed. That includes China, by the way, and it also includes the internal politics of the US, because at certain point the credibility of their targets starts to wane if they are not able to back it up with domestic politics. So we keep an eye on that. And the second part, so the first part is very simple. We fought for that deadline in 2022, and we now have to fill it with real substance in terms of the missing NDCs. The second one is finance, and the EU feels responsible for getting that on the table in terms of we felt and still feel responsible for the 100 billion. The EU and its member states have delivered way more than the fair share in that 100 billion, but that's not a problem. That's actually what we are responsible. That's taking responsibility. But also the discussion on loss and damage in the context of what we call the Santiago network. There's one driver for that, which is the EU. Obviously, there's many other recipients for that, which is, and rightfully so, the vulnerable and the least developed countries, etc. But if we want to make that happen, we can't rely on the US. We have to take the helm and steer that into the right direction. And also, at some point, and obviously we can't wait too long with that, so next year we have to involve China in that conversation. Because China is not at the receiving end anymore of that money, but it's not at the giving end either. And at some point in time, we have to have an understanding on broadening the donor base for climate finance, be it adaptation, mitigation, or loss and damage. And that conversation needs to start at some point. We can't avoid that any longer. The EU feels responsible for this whole framework, and these are our priorities for the next year.
Thank you, Diederik, and this really gives me the opportunity to turn directly to Li. So thank you for facilitating the flow here, because China has been mentioned, and the need to sooner or later include China into the donor side of the climate finance mechanisms. So Li, in your view, what will be the priorities next year of China, India, and other Asian countries on climate, but what should be, in your view, also their priority in this space?
Sure. No, I think when we look at the global climate regime, we are since the adoption of the Paris Agreement, now with the completion of the Paris Rulebook, we are increasingly transitioning from international regime building to more domestic implementation. Right. So I think the number one priority for countries like China, I think to some extent, India, many other countries, is how do we build more domestic incentives, right? So that we can propel and accelerate climate action. I think this will be actually the main theme over this upcoming decade. We need to pay more and more attention to the domestic politics of different countries, and try to kind of build better conditions to help them move forward with reducing their emissions. I think for China in particular, and this is sort of at the intersection between the international and the domestic level, I think the more that we manage to keep the climate agenda a bit away from the more toxic part of our bilateral relationship, for example, with the US, the better we will be able to preserve domestic political conditions for climate action. I can also see a few kind of concrete near-term progress that need to be made next year. For China, our industrial sectors, our provinces, can we ensure many of them come up with peaking timeline and peaking plan that is in line and, hopefully, goes beyond the national timeline. I think that's going to be very, very critical. We are, having a domestic conversation on the future role of coal, and we need to accelerate that conversation. To some extent, the recent energy crisis that is happening in China complicates that conversation quite a bit. And I can also see opportunities when it comes to reducing non-CO2 gases, in particular methane. I think it will be a very important area where the country makes some effort. It has been kind of an area missing on the policy agenda. And I think it is time for the country to come up with not only just a plan, but also concrete targets in terms of reducing methane emissions.
Thank you, Li. And I think we can perhaps get some of the questions we are really receiving, and there are quite a few of them now from our virtual audience. And the first I would like to pose to you all is the one coming from Beatrice, who asks, commitments and intentions are not enough. How do you envisage enforcement in the near future? And this perhaps also gives me the opportunity to bring into the conversation the German coalition agreement that we now have seen, which also supports, as we knew, the idea of a climate club. So Germany will use the G7 presidency next year to try to build support for a climate club. So how do you see this option in order to try to further incentivize global climate action in parallel, of course, to the Paris Agreement framework? I don't know if you, Laurence, want to go first on this.
Yeah, thank you. We have seen very interesting development around, first, of course, the idea of the carbon border adjustment mechanism that was presented by the European Commission. Before Glasgow, we saw how, where Russia in particular, but other countries were beginning to think, what do we do with that object? And it has created an effort, which I think at that stage, even if there is, of course, difficult diplomatic difficulties, to present that not as a protectionist tool, but really a way to incentivize everybody to go through the low carbon route. It has had positive effect. The deterrent effect, if I may say so, is working, which I think is already a very good element. That doesn't mean that it's very easy to use trade tools to implement the decarbonization process all over the world, but it can happen. And when you look clearly at the deforestation, for example, declaration, the commitments, the voluntary commitments, you see that the value chain and the trade elements are always in. So we are now in a way, in a moment where probably the connection between trade flows and the decarbonization agenda will happen. So we saw these carbon clubs, and now I think the sort of the word is now carbon alliances, if I'm correct, just to show that this is an open doors. It's not a closed club. Of course, is a way to respond to, it's not a protectionist tool, but we need, of course, to now accelerate action, in particular in industry. And that probably, and you sure would certainly comment on that, for China, there is a real issue about the decarbonization of the industry, meaning the energy consumed by industry. And so that is an interesting field of development. I have had in Glasgow very interesting discussion with Indian industry coordinations that we are seeing the Climate Alliance or even the CBAM as a way to support domestic action to decarbonize industrial sector and to show this is then open the markets. And so it's a complex dynamic. And of course, it requires for the EU in general, governments, the member state and the commission and the different direction of the commission to very much align, to be very much aligned in the way we explain that. But it could be a fantastic opportunity to support on the financial side, on one side, as Diederik mentioned, if broadened to other countries, and on the benefit of access to the European market. So I think it's a big opportunity. It's not the only enforcement mechanism we have. We have others. And again, that's where finance is very important, including the taxonomy there and the regulation role that the central banks will have at the end of the day. And I see another one. So I would say domestic laws, trying to push for domestic laws for implementation, as Lucio mentioned, because it's about that now. Looking at the finance system, including the central bankers' role, and there is a number of central bankers that have now adopted climate risk and decarbonization scenarios. And for me, it's a very big tool to enforce Paris in a way. And finally, yes, this carbon alliance or climate alliance that can be very promising in the future.
Thank you, Laurence. And I think that on top of India, another interesting case for this deterrence effect of the EU CBAM proposal is Turkey. No? Turkey, a country that now started to reflect seriously on the creation of an ETS, which is something that was, of course, not there before in the domestic debate as a reaction to the proposal. So I think, indeed, we are seeing already very visible positive effects here. But, Diederik, I think, I guess you in Glasgow had to explain CBAM or have conversations on CBAM with some of our trade partners. So what's your take on this? How do you see the proposal moving forward since we are now in the negotiation phase? And would you expect this to be promptly implemented as proposed by the Commission?
Well, we propose a pretty, let's say, gradual phase-in. So if you call that promptly, yes, it will be promptly, but slowly, because we all have to adapt also domestically to that new instrument. Back to your question, Beatrice, I fully understand the anxiety about all those commitments and the credibility of those. But the essence of a UNFCCC is that we do not enforce each other's commitment at gunpoint. So basically, we have to rely on indeed the UN framework in which we encourage each other to move forward. In that encouragement, new instruments are developed. And that's and there's CBAM. It is basically an additional tool to the normal EU point of view, where we say we lead by example and we will be followed because of our example. Well, that might just not be enough. So the CBAM is the assertive part of that example, where we say, okay, we lead by example, we hope that everyone follows. If not, we are a little more assertive in our trade policies in order to prevent carbon leakage and to prevent that our example is left alone at the altar and we actually reduce our CO2 emissions domestically, but increase them on a planetary scale. And as Laurence already explained, it is very effective before it's even effective. That might lead to a worry what happens if we really implement it, but so far so good. Indeed, the neighboring countries around Europe, obviously most affected by CBAM, are all of them in a conversation now about carbon pricing. So the carbon club is growing before it's even installed. And we hope that will continue. And we hope that will contribute to the enforcement, so to speak, of our climate commitments. But again, enforcement in UNFCCC language is commitment and agreement and conversation. That's what humanity is left to if we don't want to shoot each other.
Maybe one item that we perhaps didn't mention here as an example of the role of trade in fostering climate and environmental action is what the Commission itself proposed a couple of weeks ago on deforestation. No? So this idea of banning agricultural products that are linked to deforestation is indeed another way to utilize trade to foster environmental protection, which of course makes use of the European single market as a big asset for the implementation and also the fostering of the Green Deal globally, which in my view it's a very important component here. Lee, may I ask you what's your take on this enforcement point? And of course, we have mentioned China and India here, so you might also have some thoughts on that.
Well, no, I mean, in terms of the enforcement, I agree in general that international treaties, international law, well, environmental law does not carry too much teeth, right? But I think the balance that we need to restore here is the balance between ambition and implementation. I mentioned that there is an imbalance between mitigation and means of implementation, like finance, adaptation, and so on. I think an emerging new set of imbalance is this imbalance between sort of headline targets, right? And how they can actually be implemented. Because we all know at the end of the day, the climate problem will not be solved by paperwork. It will only be solved by real mitigation reduction. So I just feel like, there's kind of a dangerous tendency in the global climate politics now that people are paying a lot of attention on headline targets. Not to say headline targets are not important, but at the expense of whether we have enough policies to actually fulfill those, targets. When in fact that, implementation and ambition should be the best friends with each other, right? Because they mutually reinforce each other. We sort of trade them as enemies, right? With some countries emphasizing on we do a lot of the implementation and trying to kind of hide away from the need to ratchet up their target. Whereas, other countries are saying we have, a very ambitious target, but trying to kind of pivot away from whether they have enough policies. I think this is something that we need to restore, the balance between implementation and ambition, something that we need to restore urgently in 2022. And then just on the carbon club idea, just one word. I think from the Chinese perspective, a lot of people will pay attention to the ticket price to that carbon club, in the sense that if you don't have an explicit carbon price in the system, can you be involved in the club? And I am saying this, I guess, explicitly referencing two major emitters, that might not have an explicit carbon price in the near future. How do you deal with that? I think this is something that China will pay a lot of attention to.
Can I shortly respond to Lee on this? Because this is an interesting part where we've spent a lot of time discussing this while designing CBAM. And we came to the conclusion that so far, and I can't say it will never happen, but so far we are not able to monetize other types of regulation. So indeed, countries come to the EU and say, oh, no, we don't have a carbon price, but we have very strict regulation. Can we also be exempted from CBAM? No. So far, the proposal is pretty clear. You can obviously, if you have a very low carbon content of your product, you don't have to pay CBAM because it's based on the carbon content. But if you have a carbon content of your product, yes, you're eligible or you're subject to CBAM unless you paid at home. If you didn't pay anything at home, I think China could be less worried than, for instance, the US, because China has a carbon price, at least in part of the country, for part of the product, etc. The US has none so far. So it's going to be an interesting conversation around the table about the carbon club.
And indeed, this calls upon our US friends, because the proposal we currently have in Congress about carbon border adjustment is based on the hidden carbon price of environmental regulation. So the key question there is, of course, how do you calculate that hidden carbon price, as you, Diederik, rightly mentioned?
And if they can, I will be very thankful because or grateful for that, because we couldn't so far.
We got a question that touched upon what Laurence was mentioning before on the World Bank from Mark Plant, the co-director of the Center for Global Development, who asks, have the multilateral development banks stepped up adequately to the climate challenge? And if not, what more they need to do? So maybe, Laurence, would you like to take this one first on the multilateral development banks?
Yes, I think it's not a new topic. That's now many reports at different moments of the life of the multilateral development banks and the International Monetary Fund that something has to be done to, in a way, align the mandate of this institution vis-a-vis the climate threat. And this is not really happening. We know that the World Bank have committed to have 35% of its portfolio climate friendly or for climate. In reality, if we are serious, the whole portfolio has to be aligned. And at least maybe having, like some development banks have done, that have 50% at least of that portfolio immediately to do that. So why this is not happening? And so that's one question. The second question is, of course, the ridiculous level of the leveraging of private capital by the World Bank portfolio. And we now it's an established number that when you lend or want an investment of World Bank of $1, it's less than 25 cents that is leveraged on the capital market. So this is a second point, which of course is not part of clearly of the mandate, a little bit of IFC, of course, but not of this particular body. And I do think that this is depending, of course, of the US government, of course, a very heavy weight in the board. And I understand not thinking about changing the head of the World Bank for the moment. So there will be, we can have the same policy. So it has to be balanced then by a board that requires the World Bank to be aligned with the decarbonization scenario. And it's, and including for all the ODA part, the you know, with the subsidies part of the World Bank, considering the impact of climate change and adaptation. So this is not happening. So that's why I think EU has to take the lead with all the board members, have a discussion in EU. I think that will be part of the G7 in Germany. I understand that, which is good. But then we need to solve that problem. And I hope and then it can be combined with the offer of IMF and the discussion around the special drawing rights, their continuation. I know that there are different points of view, and we may see a German coalition government, depending on the Bundesbank vision of that. But I think it's really important to connect the two, the macroeconomic element, and of course, Simon, you are at Bruegel very well placed to think about that, and the particular development finance. And then I will add something. We have not paid sufficient attention to the local development banks in the different countries. There are an effort to understand what they can deliver, but it is the chain, no, from the MDBs to the national development banks, to, of course, the private banks in every country that has to do the job of financing the decarbonization. So this requires, in my view, a broader discussion that, again, I think we should start immediately.
Thank you, Laurence. So let me then turn to Mr. Anonymous, who asks, should there also be corporate determined contribution? And this question really goes hand in hand with several others that we are receiving about how do we engage the business here. So what would be your take on this, Diederik, maybe?
Well, it's a bit connected with what happened in the first week of Glasgow, which is not completely new, but the UK made really a show out of it in terms of all those commitments and voluntary agreements and well, it was a huge melee mix of stakeholders there. It was about countries and also companies. And it's all fine. It's all nice. It provides momentum. It provides knowledge. It provides impetus. It provides whatever you want. But the framework of the UNFCCC is about economy-wide national determined contributions. And we've battled a long time to get to that framework finally in Paris and now finalized in the rule book. That's what it should be about. So, and companies are part of a society, are part of countries and sometimes multiple countries. So they will be subject to those nationally determined contributions and the consequent policies of that. So that's what it should be. And I'm all in favor of their own initiatives, their own plans, their own ideas. In the end, they will merge and we be woven into the nationally determined contributions. And because that's the framework that we work on, and I love to make it more complicated, but it's already pretty complicated.
Can I build on what you said, Diederik, and maybe formulate that as a question to you all? Because, of course, there is this idea that all the side deals and alliances that we have seen, notably during the first week of the COP, should now in 2022 be translated into real policy action and be accounted for in new NDCs. But let's focus for a moment again on this issue of the new NDCs, because we have seen first signs of countries over the last few weeks saying, well, we don't intend to submit a new NDC. We have seen Australia saying that. We have seen a very cautious position by the United States on that. So do you expect countries to deliver on this front, or might we basically see a number of countries next year not coming up with a revised NDC?
Yeah, it's complex, no, and difficult because on the other side, preparation of Glasgow was really difficult because, of course, of the problems of really COVID plus, in a way, the weight of the withdrawal of US, which has its consequences because then climate diplomacy has gone down because, of course, there was for a number of countries a way to backtrack and feel the license just to ignore that. So this time is essential in convicting and because you have this domestic versus international discussion to prepare for that. And you cannot have, it's not, in a way, a pressure, a power politics that you oblige a country to, as Diederik said, it's a world of equals normally here in the UNFCCC. So the climate diplomacy and the capacity to encourage and in a way, shows the value of for countries to really reevaluate that is complicated. That's why I I'm not sure, of course, of Australia, what could be decided by Australia for next year. And of course, if Australia doesn't want to move and Brazil doesn't want to improve the contribution they have made, of course, it weakened all this 2022, which is a very important achievement of Glasgow. So on one side, of course, EU can show that on some sectors we accelerated action. For US, it's complex to put a new NDC. But at the other side, there is a target mainly, and it's not filled with a very precise plan. Contrary to EU, we have the Fit for 55, which is rather really precise on what we want to achieve. In reality, it was only one plan, which has really a lot of precision and, of course, some kind of reading of the Chinese proposal to are complicated to decipher. So US has not done. So at least if US put forward something that is concrete, we could, in a way, integrate that it is a progress already. But then there is all the others, Indonesia, again, Australia, Philippines, Vietnam. For the moment, the NDCs are very, very low. So that what can climate diplomacy do this year? It requires a big mobilization. And my question mark is, who will do that? Can EU take the lead? Will UK continue the efforts? Will US continue? It's a very big question mark on who will lead the climate diplomacy exercise. And I will be very happy to continue the discussion on what do we do with non-state actors. But it's not probably the moment. But I would love to have that discussion with a complete certification of UNFCCC, as Diederik put this forward. It's a very important discussion, in my view.
I think that, I mean, this point, Laurence, it seems to me to be central. So who holds the torch of global climate diplomacy next year? Is it going to be the Egyptian presidency of COP27? Is it going to be the prolonged effort of the UK diplomacy? What is going to be the role of Germany as a president due to the presidency of the G7? And of course, what is going to be the role of Indonesia due to the presidency of the G20? So to me, this is an open question, honestly. Lee, do you have any thought on this, notably from the Indonesian side?
Sure. No, I think, I think the truth is we need a diversity of leadership, right? As I just mentioned, if you look at, for example, the G2 joint statement, they are not necessarily providing the driving force as they used to do in the run-up to the 2015 Paris Climate Summit. In the run-up to Paris, what happened was their joint statement was, with regard to many key provisions, cut and pasted into the Paris Agreement. What does that mean? That means they were sort of providing the gold standard for international rules. And this time, Glasgow actually built on from the U.S.-China statement. But maybe also, just to come back to the last question. The NDC, I mean, the way that I look at the 2022 revisit and strengthening position is it provides a very strong hook, right, for us to keep the rhythm of, international climate diplomacy. So I take that very positively. But the second thing is we also need to recognize that there is also a diversity of national approaches when it comes to answering the NDC question. You clearly see two camps now, right, that are emerging. One camp, which tends to kind of overpromise and underdeliver. The other camp doing the direct opposite, underpromising and overdelivering. And I think we need to recognize that diversity, and we need to have kind of different expectation and multiple benchmarks instead of just one for those different countries. And it is indeed a key priority for us to figure out in the next few weeks what should be the expectation for an individual country in 2022.
Thank you. Anyone else that wants to intervene? Well, Diederik?
On the NDCs and the missing, let's do some backward engineering here. And we miss about 10 to 15 gigatons of emission reductions in order to get ourselves close to close to 1.5 degree. 3 to 5 gigatons of those have to come from China. In the coming year, China will specify its N+1 plan and that will shape the reduction curve. And we don't know exactly how it will be shaped. We intend to influence that as much as we can. For the close spectators, followers of this, you can see that the sort of China, EU or US statement is a sort of a relay. The US started in April with a China-US statement, which was not very overwhelming. And then we had one in September, then the US, so the EU-China statement of September. Then we had an US-China statement during the COP. We might have a new one with China as the EU somewhere in the coming months in order to drive that curve further. But it's not filling the gap. We need India, we need Indonesia, we need Australia, and we are committed to work on all of them. And hopefully, indeed, in close cooperation with the prolonged UK presidency towards COP27, with the incoming Egyptian presidency, with others that can contribute to this. We are committed not to drop this baton and to keep working until we have closed that gap towards 1.5 degrees.
Thank you, Diederik, and thank you also for mentioning this forthcoming EU-China document, which of course we will read with great interest.
I'm not sure whether it will come, but I can imagine that in the relay, it's now our
turn. Might be that as a follow-on. Sure, absolutely. Great. So I think this brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you to our speakers, Laurence, Diederik, and Lee, for the great contributions and for your time. Really, thank you very much. As usual, all of you can read in open access all the analysis of Bruegel in our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.